All rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Well, good morning. Before we begin with our first case, my notes tell me we have high school students from Loyola High School. If they are present, would they stand, please?
Loyal.
Thank you. I'm sorry.
Arpin. Loyal.
It's written correctly. It was just said wrong. Very good. Thank you very much. Please be seated. The students are here on a program called Court with Class, so they know a little bit about the case that you're going to argue to us this morning. And if you can come back at noon, Justice Annette Ziegler, who sits right down here next to me, will come and chat with you a little bit about how cases get to the Supreme Court. She doesn't discuss the merits of the case. You will have heard, but I think you'll find it very interesting. And everyone that would like to come is invited as well. So if you're not a student at Loyal High School or an advisor, you're certainly welcome to come back at noon. Before I call the first case, also, I want to let you know that Justice Shirley Abrahamson, who generally sits right here on my right-hand side, is participating today by phone. And so she's already on the phone with us. So I will try to get questions from her. If I hear them come up, it may require me to ask another justice to hold up a minute so that she can fully participate, but that's how we're going to proceed this morning. So with all of those preliminaries, we call the first case State versus Mitchell. Counsel, are you ready to proceed?
I am.
Thank you.
May it please the court this morning. My name is Linda Schaefer, and I'm here today on behalf of Mr. Gerald Mitchell. There's no doubt that drunk driving is a devastating problem on Wisconsin roads and highways and must be addressed by law enforcement with all means that fall within the Constitution and laws of the state and the nation. However, those laws must fall within the mandates of the Constitution and specifically the Fourth Amendment. The unconscious driver provision of Wisconsin's implied consent law is unconstitutional because it violates the Fourth Amendment protections that are afforded to all citizens in this country. I'm going to focus my argument on three main points.
You know, I guess I wondered if I had a fundamental question as I was preparing for this case the other day that I saw the state make a passing reference that sort of made an implicit reference to what I was thinking about. How is your argument concerning the constitutional nature of the right affected? How is that touched upon by the fact that the ability to be a licensed driver in this state is unquestionably a privilege and not a right? So we are not talking about a constitutional right to drive. We are talking about a privilege, and every driver who seeks the privilege of being a licensed driver in the state affirmatively understands and makes a showing, an affirmative showing, an express showing, that they understand, whether they do or do not, but that the record is there, that they have made the showing, that they understand that by going on the roadway, they have consented to the very thing that you now say is unconstitutional. I'm trying to figure out how it can be. Please.
That's a good question. I think it's a fundamental question. The right to drive is certainly a privilege. It's not a right. We acknowledge that from the beginning. Whether or not the, shall we say, application or expression of that privilege, though, is, that's the place where the constitutional argument comes in, because as you express your right to participate in that privilege that you've been given, those constitutional rights
If you express your right to participate in the privilege, okay, I'm not, okay, please go ahead.
Okay, as, for instance, as you decide that you're going to drive, you're taking advantage of that privilege. You're expressing your interest in exercising that privilege.
Yes.
But because you're participating in something that may be a privilege does not mean that you don't also have constitutional rights while you're exercising
then,
the privilege.
Then isn't the remedy obvious? Don't sign up for a driver's license. If you don't want to be subject to the laws of implied consent, with that, which every licensed driver in this room is subject to, the remedy is clear from the beginning. At least one line of thought might be, don't get a driver's license. Nobody is compelling. The state does not compel any citizen to get a driver's license.
That's correct. People are not compelled to have a driver's license. However, typically 16-year-olds are the people who apply for and receive driver's licenses. Whether or not a 16-year-old is fully capable of understanding that argument and making that decision at age 16 for something that may not happen until they're 65.
Well, a 16-year-old's subject to absolute sobriety to begin with on
yes.
the roads of our state.
Together with additional brain development. Excuse me for all those students here, but...
Thank you for that, Justice. As a longtime teacher before I changed careers, I fully understand about brain development.
Counsel, perhaps to put a sharper point on the question, I think Justice Gableman is getting at the question of whether the state can condition the exercise of a privilege on the waiver of a constitutional right.
And I don't believe they can.
Okay, why not?
They can't in this particular case. Because the Fourth Amendment in particular offers specific protections. The Fourth Amendment also,
yes,
to some extent, offers a back door around that.
Right. So one of the back doors is consent, right? You
yes.
can consent to waive your Fourth Amendment protections.
That's correct.
Yeah. So why can't the state say, if you're going to exercise this privilege, we're going to condition that on you waiving your Fourth Amendment rights. Why can't it do that?
You can't do that because the Fourth Amendment and the Constitution are fundamental, basic premises that all citizens are entitled to.
Well, I was just traveling. I was just traveling last Saturday, mm-hmm. and the kind TSA agent told me I had to take my belt off.
Mm-hmm.
I could keep my wristwatch and my cufflinks on,
mm-hmm.
But other than that, the belt had to come off. And
mm-hmm.
It seemed pretty clear to me that the government official was telling me that if I wanted to get on the airplane, if I wanted to exercise the privilege that my ticket afforded me to do,
mm-hmm.
that it was conditioned upon all of my luggage, everything, mm-hmm. being subject to search, okay? So all of my private papers, all of the things the founders specifically put in the Fourth Amendment,
mm-hmm.
Are subject to search, ordinarily not without a warrant, probable cause in front of a neutral and detached magistrate. But I want to fly because it's a lot faster. So you now say, you took the position in answer to Justice Kelly's question, that the government cannot do that. Please
well,
explain.
The government cannot do that unless they have, for instance, asked you for your consent or obtained your consent, whether there's some other circumstance that warrants the abrogation, if you will, of that Fourth Amendment right.
Ms. Schaefer, can I get in the lineup whenever you're done with Justice Gableman's questions? So.
Certainly.
Thanks.
Certainly. When you travel through an airport,
yes.
there are signs, warnings, alerts. The public address system will offer you information, warnings, and alerts. When a person gets in the car and drives, those warnings and alerts aren't there.
When they obtain their driver's license, are they informed?
Honestly, it's been a very long time since I got my driver's license, but I don't recall ever seeing on that driver's license that I was agreeing. Maybe there was. I don't know, but it was a lot of years ago, so
okay.
I don't know.
Thank you for your answers to my questions.
Thank you.
Justice Sigler?
Right. I would like to know, I'm thinking of potential unintended consequences of your argument, and
yes.
I'd like us to think a little bit about refusal and the refusal statutes.
Yes.
And how this is at play when it comes to a refusal. If I, as a conscious driver, refuse, I then am subject to the refusal statutes and a ticket, and I can pursue and try to defend that. If I drink to the point of being unconscious, and therefore I am unable to refuse, you are asking that this court assume that the person has refused. How would the state ever prove a refusal in the scenario that you propose?
The state would, I guess what I propose is that rather than assuming that consent has not been withdrawn, I would presume that consent has not been given.
I get your argument, but when you go deeper, you're asking us to, when it comes to someone who drinks to the extent of being unconscious,
right. They
cannot receive the same ticket. And the state cannot pursue that because they could never prove that you refused. You didn't refuse. You were just unconscious under your logic. So the person who drinks to the point of unconsciousness receives a benefit and less of a penalty than someone who would not drink to the point of unconsciousness. I want you to think through that without going back to your argument that I fully understand. I think your argument means for that unconscious driver, they also escape the penalty and responsibility of a refusal violation.
I expect that you may well be correct about that, except that every decision of this court expands and elaborates on understanding. If the understanding was that inability to consent or withdraw consent is to be read as a withdrawal of consent, then that person could get a ticket, I believe, for refusal, because then it would amount to a refusal.
How would you prove that? I mean, the burden's on the state. How would they prove refusal? Would the court just say, as a matter of law, every unconscious person is guilty of a refusal ticket? There is no due process involved in attempting to argue that you did not refuse? That's a tough one. You're taking away someone's rights to require the issuer of the ticket, to prove the ticket. Or, conversely, you are placing people who have decided to drink to the point of unconsciousness in a better position than the person who did not. That's a tough one for me. So you got to help me through that a little bit, unless it's unconstitutional, and that's part of your argument, which is a whole different can of worms.
Well, I believe ultimately that it is unconstitutional to assume that that unconscious person has consented by not withdrawing their consent, that they have in fact consented.
Now think that through to the refusal scenario. How's that at play? How can that possibly work with that statute?
When a person gets a ticket for a refusal, there's a period of time during which they can request and present their case. And if they are successful in presenting a case, that the refusal was not really a refusal, then they're not.
So it's presumed that the refusal is a refusal without the county or the state or the prosecuting authority putting anything into the record.
It's presumed to be a refusal unless the person challenges it
prevails. So why wouldn't everyone who's unconscious challenge that and win?
I don't know that they would win.
How could they lose? You can't prove they refused, unless as a matter of law someone automatically gets increased penalties for being unconscious.
My position is that they should
or decrease penalties for being unconscious. I mean, they are categorized as a they are in a different category. They either receive more mm-hmm. or fewer rights mm-hmm. under your scenario. In that, you're trying to cabin this to just the OWI context, but there are other ramifications, and that's why I'm mm-hmm. asking you about the unintended consequences. Because you're either saying, well, they're automatically guilty of a refusal, or an unconscious driver can never be guilty of a refusal.
Oh, I guess I wouldn't go to the extent of saying that an unconscious driver cannot be guilty of a refusal.
Only if they decide not to put on, ask for a hearing.
That's true.
I mean, so long as their lawyer's competent and they ask for a hearing, they win.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's the presumption has to be, first of all, that their lawyer is competent, and if there's a reason to ask, if there's a way to ask for the hearing, that they will do that.
So,
you know, I would not stand here and assume incompetent legal counsel. I don't think that's right.
A counsel?
Yes.
Counsel? This is Shirley Abrahamson. Counsel, how would you like this opinion to be written? What is the, I know what the result is that you want, but what is the reasoning that you would expect this court to assume in your favor? And would you speak right into the microphone, please?
Okay.
And slowly.
Okay. Can you hear me better now?
Yes, much okay. better. Thank you.
Ultimately, at the end of this argument, we would ask that the court's decision find that, generally understood terms, that an unconscious driver, unless there are exigent circumstances, which would kind of circumvent anything that we're doing here today. Exigent circumstances is a whole other set of issues, if you will, for an intoxicated, potentially intoxicated driver. But we would expect that a statute would say something like, barring consent or an exigent circumstance, any person in the case of any person who is suspected of driving drunk, that there should be a showing of probable cause before a magistrate or a judge, and a search warrant should issue before that blood test can be taken. That's, in a nutshell, that's our argument today. We further would be arguing, of course, that consent to that blood draw, we know from case law, it needs to be actual. In order to be actual consent, it needs to be voluntary. And to take blood from an unconscious person who is suspected of driving drunk, to take that blood without that actual and voluntary consent is a violation of their Fourth Amendment.
Your response to Justice Abrahamson is highlighting for me a little bit of confusion that I had about your argument, and especially in contrast with the way you began your argument and the response to Justice Kelly's question about the government may not condition the grant of a privilege upon the waiver of a constitutional right. I understood from the way you were arguing today that the challenge that your client makes is to the implied consent statutory scheme in total. But you now say, in response to Justice Abrahamson, well, exigent circumstances is always an exception. And so I wonder, what are some examples of qualifying exigent circumstances that you would recognize to your otherwise unconstitutional argument?
So let me understand. You're asking me for some examples of what an exigent circumstance might be?
That would fit within your argument, yes. I'm trying.
Okay.
Well, first of all, so you are not making a per se You are not saying that the implied consent law, or are you saying the implied consent law is per se unconstitutional?
I believe that I believe that it is. I believe that it can be saved.
By exigence?
It can be saved by simply a building in recognition of a search warrant before taking that blood sample an unconscious person.
Well, a search warrant is a whole different animal. You said, though, just a moment ago, and I wrote it down, exigent circumstances is always an exception. I wonder, what do you mean by that?
Okay. I'm referencing back in particular to the McNeely case.
To what?
I'm sorry?
I didn't hear you.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm referencing back to some federal case law, in particular the McNeely case, which teaches us that exigent circumstances
that implied consent laws are constitutional.
But an exigent circumstance, a case needs to be considered case by case in order to determine whether there's an exigent circumstance that warrants taking a blood sample without a warrant.
Are you simply asking us to apply McNeely? Is that what you're doing?
I'm asking you to consider McNeely in applying, in further developing case law in Wisconsin with regard to the implied consent rules, yes.
Tell me, I'm genuinely confused now, because when I asked you if you are challenging the constitutionality of the implied consent law, you said yes.
Yes.
But now you run to McNeely, which says, as its starting point, implied consent laws are constitutional. However, the dissipation of alcohol by and of itself does not constitute an exigent circumstance such as to excuse the warrant requirement under the Fourth Amendment.
Exactly.
So I cannot reconcile, and maybe you can't either, your two statements that it's unconstitutional unless you're just asking us to apply McNeely, which I...
What I'm asking this court to do is to expand or develop further law in Wisconsin such that an unconscious person is afforded the same constitutional protections that rise out of a showing of probable cause and a warrant, which is part of the Fourth Amendment. Because
unless there are exigent circumstances.
Exactly.
So give me, please, if you would, give me one or two examples of exigent circumstances that, in your mind, would have saved the blood draw in this instance as being constitutional under your view of the statutory scheme.
In Mr. Mitchell's case, there was no exigent circumstance. It wasn't ever argued.
I'm asking you to tell me what there could have been.
Oh, okay.
To make it.
Thank you. Sure. For instance, had there been a horrible accident and there were cars strewn across the freeway, injured people, traffic to consider, the officers have many responsibilities, many things they need to deal with. Maybe they wouldn't have had time to get that person. I think of northern Wisconsin, where you're 60 miles away from a hospital. Maybe they couldn't get that done within that window of... I think of it as automatic admissibility. It's really not, but admissibility of the blood information. So there's one. Another one might be maybe you didn't know when the drunk driving happened. You don't know how much time has passed.
Counsel, if I may, are those two examples enough, or do you want more?
I think I understand what you are saying.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I took your response to the question of how it would be written, and you said, barring consent or exigent circumstances, there should be a showing of probable cause and a search warrant.
Yes.
And I took that, when I heard you say that, I thought, that's exactly what Birchfield says at page 2184, talking about, you know, how... what you need, and of course we're here in part to develop the law Given the federal development of the law under McNeely and Birchfield, which are two federal cases that really have addressed blood draws and changed the landscape a bit as to how state courts employ implied consent and or blood draws. In 2184, consent, of course, and then the court in Birchfield says, nothing prevents the police from seeking a warrant for a blood test where there's sufficient time to do so in the particular circumstance, or from, so in other words, getting a warrant, okay, or from relying on exigent circumstances. And then after one additional paragraph, they say this with regard to the unconscious driver, which we have here. It's true that a blood test, unlike a breath test, may be administered to a person who's unconscious, perhaps as a result of a crash, or who is unable to do what is needed to take a breath test due to profound intoxication. But we have no reason to believe such situations are common in drunk driving arrests. Now, this is the punchline. And when they are, the police may apply for a warrant if needed. And when don't you need a warrant? Well, if there's consent or if there's exigent circumstances, as they described in the paragraph above. So, one above. So, seems to me that's the template that Birchfield set out, and although you weren't citing the Birchfield, that's pretty much what you said in response to your answer of how the opinion should be written. So, I understand Birchfield. How does McNeely fit into your comment?
McNeely fits in not so much because we're dealing with exigent circumstances here today. We're not. But McNeely fits in because it offers some other guidance as to how a drunk driving situation might be considered. In McNeely, we have some discussion of case-by-case determination that applies to exigent circumstances. But we also learn that any determination needs to be based on totality of circumstances, which is a determination that can only be made at the time that this incident happens. A person who may have provided an implied consent when they got their license, maybe 5 years ago, maybe 50 years ago, can't know what the circumstances may be when that incident happens. Therefore, because you can't make a totality of circumstances evaluation, I'm sorry, my red light just came on.
Yeah, please finish your answer.
Okay,
yeah.
Because you can't make that determination before the incident happens, therefore that consent isn't voluntary, that implied consent can't be considered a voluntary consent. And if it's not voluntary, then it can't be considered an actual consent, which takes me back to my basic position that we don't have consent for an unconscious driver. In this case, we didn't have an exigent circumstance, we didn't have consent, and we didn't have a warrant. Therefore, that blood draw would fall outside the permissions of the Fourth Amendment.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the Court. Chief Deputy Solicitor General Ryan Walsh on behalf of the State of Wisconsin. Before I yield my time to non-party Mothers Against Drunk Driving, I want to make two points this morning. First, consistent with part one of our brief, I want to explain why the search in this case satisfied the consent exception to the warrant rule. And then second, consistent with part two of our brief, and I think consistent also with the Mothers Against Drunk Driving brief, I'd like to explain why the search in this case of an unconscious driver who had been properly arrested for drunk driving passes muster under the general reasonableness standard. So starting with consent, as Justice Allison Ide of the Colorado Supreme Court has recently put it, the question whether consent under a statute like this one, the question whether that consent is sufficient under the Fourth Amendment, is truly not an open question. Here is what the court in Birchfield said. Quote, it is well established that sometimes consent need not be expressed, but may be fairly inferred from context. That's a paragraph addressed directly to implied consent laws, just like Wisconsin's, which is why Birchfield goes on to say that we have generally approved of laws such as this. So to respond to Justice Bradley's point, it is true that there is the paragraph that you quoted, but in a separate paragraph, Birchfield says, don't read anything in this opinion to cast doubt on the constitutionality of implied consent laws.
So let me...
Just a minute, if I may. Then the next sentence after they say, yes, you know, we've generally acknowledged the implied consent laws, the next sentence goes on to state, but that doesn't mean they're without limitation.
That's exactly right.
That's right.
And that's
and
part
so
two.
That's why we're here today, to see what those limitations are.
And that's part two of our brief. We are completely open about the fact that the legislature cannot create any old implied consent statute that it wishes. Birchfield makes clear that there is a limit to what drivers can be deemed to have consented to by virtue of the decision to drive.
Okay, before you go too far on that point, I want to back up to an intriguing question that you asked, or statement that you made about Birchfield. Birchfield itself says, don't let anything we say in here cast any doubt on the constitutionality of implied consent statutes, except that what Birchfield did in itself, I think, cast doubt on implied consent statutes. I think it's unavoidable. Here's why. So the holding of Birchfield is that you cannot do a blood test as a search incident to arrest for OWI, right?
Right.
Okay. So tell me how that differs from a statute that says you can do a blood test as an incident to an arrest for OWI.
How that differs from this statute?
Yes.
Well, the statute, the difference is that a consent statute provides an alternative basis for a reasonable search with limitation. If there were a criminal penalty attached to the condition of implied consent.
Let's not go into penalties for the moment. I want to focus on the bare holding of Birchfield and how that, I want to see how that conceptually differs from an implied consent statute, right? Because Birchfield says just because you're arresting somebody for OWI doesn't mean you get to take a blood test. The implied consent statute says, because you're arresting somebody for an OWI, you get to take a blood test.
With respect, here's the analysis that Birchfield undertakes. It says that to determine whether to apply the warrant rule, we have to consider two things. On the one hand, under general reasonableness principles, the interest of the government, and on the other hand, the degree of intrusion posed by the search at issue. And in a very long paragraph, the court explains why blood draws in the conscious driver search incident to arrest context are more intrusive. For one thing, the driver is conscious, so the driver experiences the slight discomfort that attends a blood draw. An unconscious driver does not experience that discomfort. Furthermore, an unconscious driver can be expected to be treated in a medical setting. These cases are often treated as emergencies. This person, for example, Mr. Mitchell, had already had a catheter inserted and was being treated in an emergency room and was later transferred to an ICU. So that the degree of intrusion is less, including also because we have to, under reasonableness standards, consider the intrusion in light of available alternatives. And we know that with an unconscious person, a breath test is not an available alternative.
That doesn't answer the question of consent, though. Right. So whether you do this, you know, I'm looking at the end result of this, right? Do you get to get this person's blood? And Birchfield says just because he's arrested for OWI doesn't mean that you get his blood. And the implied consent statute with respect to a conscious individual says, yes, just because you arrest him, that does mean, at least one of the opinions in Brar said, that does mean you get this person's blood. So I'm trying to find out what the distinction is. The act is exactly the same. You stick a needle in, you draw the blood out, right?
The result is the same, but I think you're using a sentence in Birchfield in a vacuum, which cuts against the later line that says you shouldn't be reading this opinion to cast doubt on civil civilly enforce implied consent laws. I think you're also, under that very strong reading of that sentence, I think you're rendering completely unnecessary the several paragraphs or the single large paragraph about the legitimacy of civilly backed implied consent laws. So I don't think that's the best reading of Birchfield. I think Birchfield...
Which sentence am I reading too strongly?
The sentence that... Something to the effect that it can't be that an officer can draw blood simply because they've made an arrest.
Well, that was the holding of the case.
No, with respect, the holding of the case is that there is a limit to an implied consent statute that a state may wish to devise. We know from case law that implied consent is a real phenomenon. The question is...
Yeah, hang on. So the court was considering breath tests versus blood tests and whether you could do one or the other or both. As an incident to arrest, right?
That's correct.
And it says, thou shalt not do a blood test as an incident to an arrest, right?
Yes.
Is there any wiggle room in that?
No, okay. There is not wiggle room. But this case doesn't involve that doctrine.
No, well, I know, except that we have a statute that essentially codified a search incident to an arrest.
Well, let me make an analogy to McNeely. One of the most frequent arguments you hear about implied consent laws is that, well, McNeely has already dealt with this. Well, with respect, McNeely did not deal with this because McNeely dealt with one exception to the warrant requirement, just like Birchfield dealt with one exception to the warrant requirement. Both cases went out of their way to make clear that implied consent laws with civil penalties are still fine. In fact, the state in McNeely had made arguments to the effect that if the McNeely court adopted the rule that it did, it would be bad for state interests. Here's what the plurality said in response. Not to worry, states. We recognize that you might not love our rule. States, you retain a broad range of legal tools to obtain as expeditiously as possible evidence of constantly dissipating blood alcohol content. So I think, with respect, I think you're reading those opinions a bit too broadly. Here's another thing that's interesting about Birchfield. Birchfield cites two cases, Jardines and Marshall. Those are very helpful here for a couple reasons. First, take Jardines. Jardines is a case where detectives enter the constitutionally prescribed curtilage of a home, and the question was whether they had implicit leave to do so. The court said yes, and for the court it was enough that Mr. Jardines had engaged in voluntary conduct against the backdrop of a legal rule that made it reasonable to infer that Mr. Jardines did not object to the entry of the police. And the common law backdrop rule in that case was having a door knocker on your door or a front path. There are a lot of inferences you can draw from a person having a door knocker on their front door or a front path, but one reasonable inference is that they consent, according to the common law rule, to people coming up to their door. In Marshall, for example, it was important that the person had engaged in a heavily regulated activity with a long history of government oversight. To Justice Gableman's point about a privilege, when a person accepts a privilege, you accept the benefits and the burdens of the privilege.
And
people agree to all kinds of conditions.
To that point, Mr. Walsh, I asked your opposing counsel, and her recollection of it was dim. I wonder, does the record contain the means by which drivers in this state, once they obtain the privilege or concurrent with obtaining the privilege to drive on the public roadways, are informed about the implied consent. Is that within the record of this case?
I don't believe it's in the record, but it isn't a publicly available document. The Wisconsin DMV handbook sets forth at length the nature of the implied consent
law. Are you talking about the motorist handbook?
The thing I read was bigger than that.
Okay. Well,
how about a bread box?
But a public, yeah. How much bread? It's a publicly available document. Well, what is the nexus?
But,
I mean, if it's in the record, that's what you see, Mr. Walsh, by the line of questionings that has been coming from the bench, that I'm wondering if there's something in the record that shows the nexus between the existence of the implied consent law and the notice that new drivers or people renewing their license may receive in regard to that, or is it just the general idea that people, that the law imputes knowledge to the citizen?
It is the latter. For in-state drivers, they're presumed to know the law that governs their conduct. They're also presumed to have read the DMV handbook. We're not arguing that we have to prove that they have, but it is presumed that they have done so. And even with respect to out-of-state motorists, they too are presumed to understand the law that governs their conduct. As Justice Kelly pointed out in his separate opinion in State versus Weber, we make inferences all the time based on people's understanding of the laws that govern their conduct. There's a limit, but there are inferences that are reasonable within the context of the Fourth Amendment analysis. If I can add to that, I think Your Honor is absolutely right to note that when people accept privileges, they agree to all kinds of conditions that they might not think to question and they might not even like. To obtain the privilege to operate a dangerous vehicle on public roads, people agree to take a driver's test, to pay for a license, to take out insurance on their car, and even to provide reasonable assistance to people injured in an accident in which they're involved. There's a liberty interest against that, you might say. Nonetheless, no one thinks to question those reasonable conditions. To that list, the implied consent law merely adds one more reasonable condition. Now, there's been some argument about whether the legislature made the right policy choice here. I think the critiques of the legislative choices in this statute are entirely misplaced. To go to Justice Ziegler's point, the legislature had two choices with respect to unconscious drivers. They could have said, officers, just presume that they've revoked, in which case now we're penalizing people on the basis of nothing. We have no idea whether they've revoked. Or they could have said, they could have adopted the unconscious driver loophole. They could have said, well, an unconscious driver, we can't presume that they've consented. So, if you drink, drive, and manage to stay conscious, you're put to the choice of whether to withdraw consent or accept the penalties. But if you happen to drink yourself to the point of unconsciousness, or if you get so intoxicated that you cannot properly operate a motor vehicle and you crash it, well, now the police can't infer anything from your conduct, and the police have to get a warrant, and you are subject to no refusal penalties. That creates a terrible incentive under the law. To strike down the unconscious driver provision would be to encourage people to feign unconsciousness.
But if the legislature wanted that, couldn't they have done that more directly than doing this roundabout Rube Goldberg structure by which we infer consent by statute as an exception to the Fourth Amendment? By that, he's unconscious, so he couldn't revoke it. Couldn't you just say, as a legislature, if you get found passed out from drink, that's an automatic revocation?
They could have done so, but instead, I think I've read Your Honor's opinion in Brar. It's very thoughtful, but I think it makes a few mistakes with respect, and this is one of them. In three separate subsections, the law points out that a driver who is incapable of withdrawing consent is presumed not to have withdrawn consent. That is how consent law works in every Fourth Amendment context. I'll give you an example. Suppose the police are investigating a drug user or a suspected drug dealer. They come to the person's house, they see him in the yard, and they say, may we search your home? The suspected drug user says yes, but then when they're two feet away from the front door, he says, on second thought, I've changed my mind, you may not search. Well, no one would doubt that the police now lack consent. Now suppose the same facts, but when they're 2 feet away from the front door, now the suspected drug dealer doesn't say anything. He passes out. Under Mitchell's view of the law, there is now a constitutionally imposed affirmative obligation to wake up the suspected drug user and check in with the person.
Right.
Do you still consent?
Yeah. And if I were to grant your premise, then I would grant what follows from it as well. I just have, expressed in my opinion in Brar, I have problems with the premise that he has given consent to begin with.
Counsel, I wanted to shift your focus a little bit from many of the questions that have been answered. And as I review these drunk driving cases, and we seem to have several every term, and they're very serious, the Fourth Amendment prohibits only unreasonable searches. And we seem to skip over that in our analysis. And my question to you is, as we determine whether this search was unreasonable, should we consider the mayhem and the constant slaughter and harm that drunk drivers cause on our highways? Or is that just out the window? We don't worry about that. We focus only on the Fourth Amendment right of the person who is driving under the influence.
That detail is front and center, and it's especially compelling here because not only are we dealing with the especially compelling interest on the part of the state to prosecute drunk driving cases and to prevent drunk driving, we're dealing with the worst of the worst. We're dealing with people who have either drunk themselves unconscious or have intoxicated themselves so much that they're unable to operate a vehicle. The state's interest could not be higher. And you're absolutely right, Your Honor, that under the Fourth Amendment general reasonableness analysis, we do start with the nature and extent of the state's interest. We then turn to the degree of intrusion posed by the search, and as we've discussed already a little bit, it's not the same kind of search at issue in Birchfield. This is an unconscious person who doesn't feel the discomfort. This person has been properly arrested, and Maryland versus King says that there is a diminished expectation of privacy for people who have been arrested, can't do a breath test, and is already receiving medical care because these cases are frequently emergencies. Now, the response is usually, well, why can't you just get a warrant? Well, with respect, Birchfield questions whether the warrant requirement should be reflexively applied in this context. There are two reasons for the warrant requirement: to provide a second check on the officer's probable cause determination, or to limit the scope of the search at issue. Neither of those are at play here. The officer, Birchfield says that the magistrate is in a poor position to second-guess the officer's characterization of the facts, and the magistrate will never be in a position to limit the scope of the search. The search will always be the same.
So, counsel, blood evidence. Are you saying there's a way to get to the search without the implied consent statute and without resort to search incident to an arrest? Is there another way?
Yes. But let me be very clear about this. We agree with the Mothers Against Drunk Driving. We think that if you conclude that consent under the statute is not alone sufficient under the Fourth Amendment, we think that given in part the existence of the statute, which puts people on notice, that's important under Maryland versus King, plus the fact that this is not an especially intrusive test, plus the fact that the state's interest could not be higher, renders this a reasonable kind of search. Not in every case, certainly not in conscious driver cases, but where there's an unconscious driver, there's unquestioned probable cause to arrest, and there's been an arrest, and the person is or can be expected to receive medical care. I expect you'll hear more about that.
Would we call that an exigent circumstance?
I would not. I don't think I could under McNeely.
Okay. Well, McNeely dealt with conscious drivers, right? Okay. Did McNeely or Birchfield say anything about that would preclude exigent circumstances from being applied to unconscious drivers?
I think it would depend on whether the officer is dealing with an emergency. I don't know that the state could ignore the parts of McNeely that say, we want to know how long it takes to get a warrant. We don't have anything in the record about that in this case.
Okay.
And there's the interesting exchange between the majority and Chief Justice Roberts in McNeely. Chief Justice Roberts says, if you have time to get a warrant, you have to get it. If you don't have time, you don't need to get it. Well, the court responds by saying that, well, what if the hospital is close by? And that's this case, by the way. By the time they realize he's losing consciousness, the hospital is an 8-minute drive away. So exigent circumstances, as articulated in McNeely, doesn't quite deal with the problem. But as I've said, McNeely, I think, was aware of that point, at least the McNeely plurality was, and they pointed out that there are these alternative ways for the state to satisfy its extremely compelling interest here.
So do we – could I just get one follow-up question? Is there a label we would put to the reasonableness that you would use to say we don't need to use implied consent to get to the blood test?
Well, there are different ways to put it. One way you could put it is that it's implied consent plus a reasonableness backstop. That's how we briefed it, part one and part two of our briefs. Another way to put it is how the Seventh Circuit put it in the Began case that Justice Gableman discussed in Howes, which is that implied consent is not quite the same as express consent. It is legitimate, but there have to be the other hallmarks of reasonableness. So you could follow the path of the Seventh Circuit in McGann, or you could simply do what the Supreme Court does on occasion in Riley, in Houghton, in Maryland versus King, and simply say, well, we have to balance the state interest and the privacy interest to determine whether it even makes sense to apply the warrant requirement here. And I expect you'll hear more about that when I sit down.
You've been waiting, Justice Bradley. Why don't you go ahead and ask your question?
Though, isn't this alternative with the reasonableness analysis, as I understand your main position, is that implied consent equals actual consent, period.
Yes, it can. That's right.
Oh, implied consent doesn't always equal actual consent?
Well, as we said in our brief, the state could not pass a law that says by driving, you consent to a search of your home anytime the officers show up. They couldn't do that because that exceeds the reasonable limit of the Fourth Amendment.
Yes, I'm talking about OWI and implied consent. I understand your argument to be implied consent equals actual consent in the OWI context.
For the unconscious driver properly arrested, correct?
Then I ask, why is it that there has to be informing the accused? Why does the legislature require for the conscious driver informing the accused if there's already actual consent?
That's an important question. I'm glad you asked it, Your Honor. The informing the accused form is not a constitutional mandate. It's a best practice. This person is conscious. The state has determined it makes sense, given circumstances have changed, to double check with the person. Are you sure you mean to do what your conduct has conveyed that you mean to do? The state shouldn't be penalized for giving the person who has managed not to knock himself out.
But it's not necessary.
It is not constitutionally necessary. It bolsters the reasonableness.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, my name is Kevin St. John. I'm a member of this Court's Bar in good standing. I'm here to introduce Attorney Lauren Glass. She is a member of the California State Supreme Court Bar in good standing, has been admitted to practice pro hoc in these proceedings, and with the Court's continued permission, will present oral argument on behalf of our clients, Mothers Against Drunk Driving.
We are pleased with her participation. Please begin.
Thank you, Your Honors, and good morning. Lauren Glass of Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher, representing non-tardy Mothers Against Drunk Driving.
Counsel, would you kindly pull that microphone a little bit?
You bet. Thank Is that better? Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you for letting us participate in argument today. Since 1980, Mothers Against Drunk Driving has been fighting for a nation with no more victims. Although there are half as many drunk driving fatalities as there were in 1980 when the organization was founded, drunk driving is still the leading cause of death on Wisconsin's roadways and on roadways across the nation. Law enforcement must continue to have the tools it needs to bring those numbers down still further. One such tool would be a categorical rule that a warrantless blood draw in a medical setting taken from an unconscious drunk driver whom the police have probable cause to arrest for drunk driving is reasonable under the Fourth Amendment. We submit there are four categorical differences between conscious and unconscious drunk drivers that justify this proposed rule. First, as a general matter, unconscious drunk drivers pose a greater threat to public safety than conscious ones, and I'll elaborate on each of these points as the Court would like. Accordingly, the government's interest in dealing with these folks is heightened. Second, for unconscious drunk drivers, a blood draw is always the least invasive alternative to get necessary BAC evidence. Third, unconscious drunk drivers generally have lesser privacy interests than conscious ones, given that they're on the roadway, they're subject to arrest, and they've left decisions about their health and safety to be made by other people. Fourth and finally, the police are always, in every case, subject to a greater burden in the case of unconscious drunk drivers because these drivers will always require some kind of medical attention. And we want the police to attend to that first before necessarily attending to the law enforcement concerns. So at bottom, we think this case comes down to a simple principle. Law enforcement should not be hindered in obtaining the only admissible evidence of wrongdoing in these cases from a class of persons who categorically pose a greater risk to public
safety. If
there's
time to get a warrant, how does that enter into your argument, counsel? By the way, welcome to Wisconsin.
Thank you. It's great to be here. I don't think it factors in, Your Honor, for the following reason. So as this Court knows, the touchstone of the Fourth Amendment is reasonableness. If a search is reasonable, balancing the nature of the government interest at stake and the degree of individual intrusion, then a warrant isn't necessary. And as Mr. Walsh alluded to, in this case, there are reasons why a warrant wouldn't necessarily serve any additional safeguard, and it would be more burdensome in this case, even as compared to conscious drunk drivers, to get a warrant.
Is this the kind of categorical exception that the Neely Court eschewed? How's that? The Neely Court talks about, of course, totality of the circumstances, and it seems I hear you arguing for a categorical exception for unconscious drivers, and of course that's not the normal categories that we have seen over the years for the exception to the warrant requirement.
That's right, Your Honor. I think McNeely was considering exigent circumstances and said we don't want to create a categorical rule that there are exigent circumstances just by nature of the dissipation of blood in the bloodstream. But we think there are things that are unique. I think as Justice Ziegler said, these drivers are in a different category. There's a narrow, readily identifiable group of people, and there are four reasons why we think a categorical rule is appropriate here where it wouldn't necessarily be in the case of a conscious driver. So greater public interest across the board in dealing with these individuals. Either they've caused a crash, and that's why they've become unconscious, in which case the act speaks for itself. Obviously, the state has a greater interest in preventing actions that cause harm to others or to the individuals themselves. And if they haven't caused a crash and they've just been found, as in the case of Mr. Mitchell, then the state has a greater interest in deterrence because these people have gone to the point of unconsciousness that, and then decided to, you know, get behind the wheel. Obviously, the state has a greater interest in preventing that. In addition, we have the medical emergencies, which is attend to every unconscious driver case. There's always going to be some need to take these folks to the hospital. Not true for conscious drivers. And then there's critically what the court discusses in Birchfield. There's no less invasive alternative here. We don't want a rule that would allow drivers, by virtue of their own conduct, to prevent the police from getting the very evidence they need to secure a conviction or to secure a sentence.
That kind of dovetails back to my question. Isn't a lease offensive or intrusive alternative if the time is available to get a warrant?
I don't think so. I don't think we should. I would start with an analogy to Birchfield. So Birchfield says we will allow, doing the same kind of categorical balancing analysis that we proposed here, we will allow warrantless breath tests of conscious drunk drivers because this is the least invasive alternative, and we don't think the warrant requirement would really serve any additional purpose. Probable cause is going to be the same for arrest versus determining whether you need to search, and the scope of the search is limited by the statute to a narrow category of items. And so we think it's only logical to have a rule that would allow the equivalent least invasive alternative, a blood test, for unconscious drivers. There's no other option. The state has a heightened interest, and the warrant requirement is equally diminished or less effective in this particular circumstance. Plus, it would impose an additional burden on law enforcement that would not be present in the conscious driver cases because they always need to attend to the driver's medical needs, and that is, in fact, what we want them to be doing as reasonable human beings.
Well, what would happen if we agreed with you and we said, look, it's the natural dissipation, metabolization of alcohol, plus the fact that he's unconscious, and based on that, we hold that there is a categorical exception to the Fourth Amendment to take a blood draw. And let's say that goes back to the Birchfield court, right? So let's say the same makeup of the court as in Birchfield. What would they say about that? Would they say, tisk tisk, we already said that search incident to an arrest is not sufficient here. And we said before in McNeely that the metabolization of alcohol is not sufficient to get around the Fourth Amendment. What would they say if we held that it's the unconsciousness plus the dissipation that warrants an exception per se to the Fourth Amendment?
I think they'd be okay with it, and here's why. I understand
that. Like a good idea to me, huh?
I understand the passage that I believe Justice Bradley was referring to earlier, saying, you know, ordinarily we don't think that unconscious drunk driver cases are very common, and so if they arise, the police can get a warrant, you know, maybe if they need to. We would submit a couple of distinctions there. So first, Birchfield wasn't directly considering the unconscious driver situations. I think it was looking at the case, and it wasn't willing to say we are willing to justify warrantless blood draws solely because they are the least invasive alternative for this narrow category of people. We're not going to justify it for everybody based on this small group. And so they weren't directly considering how all of these factors play out with respect to unconscious drunk drivers. In addition, I think the court respectfully may have misunderstood or underestimated the need for guidance in this area and just how common or how much of a risk these unconscious drunk driver cases can be. As we cited in our brief, half of all OWI citations in Wisconsin involve a BAC at which above which an individual can begin to lose consciousness. And so this might come up with a lot of frequency. There isn't hard data on this. Neither Wisconsin nor the federal government breaks this down on a sort of micro level. But it may come up with some regularity, and when it does, the same factors that we've been discussing are present in every case.
So what made the Birchfield court so uncomfortable with blood draws as a search incident to an arrest? Why were they so taken aback by that?
I would submit that in the case of the conscious driver, it's because there's a less restrictive alternative available, and there's a greater intrusion. As Mr. Walsh was saying, in the conscious driver case, if you're squeamish about having your blood drawn or it hurts or you have any other concerns, you'll be aware of that, obviously, and there's an equally or similarly effective mechanism to get the evidence you need in that case. Obviously, with unconscious drunk drivers, as the Birchfield Court acknowledges, that just isn't possible. Moreover, they're often receiving medical attention already, which may be even more invasive than a blood draw. And because they're unconscious, they're not going to feel any attendant pain or uncomfort, discomfort. And these were things that Birchfield didn't directly consider, but that would obviously be relevant to the analysis.
Please, go ahead.
One of the things they did consider, if I recall this portion of Birchfield correctly, is that the blood draw not only is it intrusive physically, but it provides information beyond that vis-a-vis privacy. And that comes to mind as I listen to the morning news and privacy interests are being discussed nationally. How does that concern for privacy, once you have a blood draw, you can find out much more than blood alcohol content of the individual?
Well, that's certainly true, Your Honor. I would submit that, and again, our argument doesn't depend on the statute, doesn't depend on consent. But
Birchfield, I think, talked about that, the ancillary privacy interests.
It does. I suppose I was just going to say that in this case, the blood draw and what the police can use the blood for is narrowly circumscribed. I believe it's just to detect the presence of alcohol, a controlled substance analog, or other drug, or a combination thereof. It's not permitting people to screen for pregnancy or other medical conditions or other more invasive types of things, and I think that's a relevant distinction. I see, my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you. Rebuttal, counsel?
Thank you. I have several points that I'd like to make here. I hope I don't get too turned around in my notes. They're a little battery here. I would like to, first of all, address something that I think we all understand, but no one has said here yet today, is that the Fourth Amendment is part of the Bill of Rights to the Constitution, the purpose of which was to ensure protection of the rights of citizens and of individuals. It is not necessarily ever intended to make the job of law enforcement somehow easier. The function is to protect the individual rights of citizens.
Counsel, if we were to require the officer to get a warrant in these circumstances, isn't it pretty much a given that the warrant's going to issue?
I don't know that. I guess I can't say that for sure. I don't have statistics before me to know, and not being a judge or magistrate, I don't see those cases on my desk.
Sure. However, so let's pretend along with me. So the officer calls in and says, Judge, I have a person behind the wheel. He's passed out. I smell strong intoxicants, and I'd like a warrant to get a blood alcohol, to get a blood sample so we can test for alcohol. Under what circumstances would a judge say no?
I don't know that in that particular example that a judge would say no. But, for instance, in the case of Mitchell, who was conscious when he was picked up and only became unconscious much later while he was in custody, there was concern on the part of law enforcement that he may be having a medical situation rather than an alcohol situation. That may be a case where a judge would have inquired further into probable cause. Now, whether a warrant would have issued or not, I don't know. We're into hypotheticals here, and I can't answer that. But
counsel for the state and for Mothers Against Drunk Driving say it is first off a question of reasonableness that we need to consider. And how could it be unreasonable when you have a person who is suspected of OWI and then passes out to not take a blood test? How is it possible that that would be an unreasonable thing to do?
I would submit to this court that reasonableness is a subjective standard. It depends on the knowledge, information, circumstances, not only of the incident and the suspected drunk driver, but also of the officer who was trying to investigate the situation. By putting the facts to a magistrate or a judge who is trained, experienced, if you will, in making those kinds of determinations, there's a much greater protection, not only for the officer who may not be well experienced in making determinations of probable cause or reasonableness, if you will, it also protects that driver, it protects their basic Fourth Amendment privacy protections, which is, as we say, you know, I mean, that's a very important part of the Fourth Amendment. That's what it's for, to protect the privacy interest of the citizens. Requiring law enforcement to make a showing of probable cause if they can't find consent and if there is no other circumstance. It's reasonable, then, for that law enforcement officer to gather his probable cause, get it to a magistrate, and get a warrant. Now, at the time that the Mitchell incident happened, we were a little newer into the whole warrant for a blood draw process than we are now. Several years have passed. At this time, at least in the counties where I practice, which is probably four or five counties in northeast Wisconsin, the counties all have smooth, streamlined, quick procedures for getting those warrants. A matter of minutes is all they need. It's not a long process. So it's reasonable for law enforcement to obtain that warrant. It's reasonable, then, to protect those basic fundamental privacy rights that all citizens have, whether they're conscious or unconscious. You still maintain your Fourth Amendment rights.
But even assuming you're right that you can get a warrant, that's sideways to the issue of what this does to the refusal statute and a refusal. So even if you'd like that to be a best practices way of, you know, and there are concerns with that. Oh, my gosh, I need to get my warrant, so never mind your medical needs. I'm going to make sure I attend to getting a warrant. That's not what you're asking for, really, but your red light is on. It's an argument that's sideways to the issue of refusal, it seems to me.
Thank you. Well, thank you both for very interesting arguments. This is a question that one would think the U.S. Supreme Court would pick up at some particular point in time. And I see this case as very significant because the issue is squarely presented. So we are going to enjoy working through it later on today, and your briefs were excellent on all sides, so thank you, as were your oral arguments. We're going to take a brief recess now so that some of the students can leave and others can come in, and we'll be back again in just a few minutes. We are adjourned.